Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 10:11 a.m. That is Eastern Summer Time, and today is Friday. It is July 5th. I'm recording a little earlier than normal because I won't be around this afternoon. But when we look at exactly what's going on in terms of the market and the justification for the fact that this S&P 500 was at a new high this week, so was the NASDAQ 100, so was the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Well, we can see from this graphic that 2018 resulted in a fairly considerable margin compression. We had significant pullbacks in the third and, in the fourth quarter, and that represented a very deep oversold condition. And then at the beginning of 2019, we had a very impressive rebound, and we've had significant margin expansion. Well, you definitely have people like value investors and the referring to the cyclically adjusted PE or the Case-Shiller PE ratio and pointing out that it's at its second highest level historically. Well, that also helps to highlight that valuations are rather rich, but that tells us nothing about the trajectory of the market. The other big point in here is that when we look at the bond markets, the total return on 10-year treasuries is at new highs, and this is a very profound change, because when we think about the outlook for the bond market, well, it really did look like it was peaking back in between about 2016 and 2018, and then it broke upwards. And when we look at this on a log scale chart, well, it was one of the most impressive bull markets in history until it lost momentum, and now we're getting an additional run on the upside. Well, then we can just clearly, if we look at these two arguments, one is that the stock market is being propelled by margin expansion, but also that the bond market is being propelled by an additional force. Well, that additional force is the fact that investors have pretty much concluded we're at the top of the interest rate cycle. But what we definitely saw in here today was a little bit of profit taking, but again, not in an especially dynamic manner. And that was following the impressive jobs report that we had in the USA. What that's, I think, confirming is that we are still in a bullish environment and the US expansion persists. There have definitely been signs of slowing growth globally, but less so in the USA. But when we look at the commonality that we have in the bond markets, where we've had significant compressions in yields, not just in the USA, but certainly in the USA, we've had a very significant failed upside break over the course of the last, 8 months. Now, there is a deep oversold condition in terms of this yield. There is, therefore, a deep or a very wide overextension in terms of the price. We also know that in the context of what has been a very consistent 7 month decline, rallies of approximately 25 to 30 basis points have been relatively normal. We're due one of those. And really, a sustained move back above the trend mean we'd be required to question that this isn't still a process of contraction in terms of the yields. The positive jobs report probably is suggesting that we're not going to have a 50 basis point cut in July. But if there is no interest rate cut, then there is going to be a very profound reaction in terms of stock market and bond market expectations. And I think that pretty much ensures that, considering the messaging we've had from central banks, particularly the Federal Reserve, that we are going to get an interest rate cut this month. But it is probably going to be of the 25 basis point variety. Generally speaking, when we think about the outlook for markets, one of the things that we see at the end of bull markets is that defensive sectors take on a great source of attraction for investors. We are starting to see that. When we look at, for example, the consumer staples sector, well, people like consumer staples because they have such long histories of increasing dividends, and the consumer staples index pushed on to new high ground this week. There is still room here for some consolidation, but it does look like there is room for additional upside. There is perhaps nothing more defensive than utilities, and utilities have been pushing higher. Of course, the reason that people like these is because they are bond proxies. They have got long histories of sustaining dividends, and the yield on the utilities index is 3%. You're getting nowhere near that on the 10-year treasury, so there is a significant pickup in the yield by looking at the higher, or I guess the companies that have got long histories of increasing their dividends. When we look at the Barclays high yield spread, then it's at about 385 basis points. So you're also getting a pickup in yield by moving further out the risk curve in the bond markets. And this yield is not expanding, or excuse me, this spread is not expanding. Well, that also suggests that there is not as much pressure. It's unlikely that it's going to go back down, but at least it is not surging higher. If it were surging higher, then that would be a suggestion that we are at a point where things are starting to get dangerous. This continues to look rather similar to the condition that we had back in early 2015. It was when the price had an, or the yield, excuse me, the spread had initially broken on the upside, then it went sideways for about 6 or 7 months, and then it started to pop on the upside. Well, it was really then the low in the market that we saw in early 2016 that set off a rather significant rally and really confirmed the end of the corrective phase. We may yet see that, but considering that central banks are already rowing in behind the view that we're at the top of the interest rate cycle and that the next significant move is downwards, I think it is worth considering where are we in terms of this long-term cycle. There is a bit of a catch-22 situation for central banks. They can't very well raise interest rates when the quantity of outstanding debt held by governments is so high. They would need to see a very clear inflationary bias, and it's just not apparent. If central banks were to start raising rates aggressively from these levels, given the debt loads that are outstanding for the majority of developed market governments, they would cause a recession of epic proportions because it would make the governments insolvent. And that's something that no central bank is going to do. So that pretty much puts a brake on just how high they can raise interest rates. That's one of the net effects of the quantitative easing program, that the quantity of debt, the monetization of debt, the fact that we have got $13 trillion of debt that is within sitting with negative yields. This has had a profound effect on the bond markets. It's also had a profound effect on the ability of governments to fund their liabilities. Well, what this suggests is that when we do eventually get a recession, then the realm of extraordinary monetary policy that and fiscal policy that is going to have to be explored is quite beyond the imaginations of what people have been willing to countenance over the course of the last decade. And that's a reasonably well accepted fact, considering the fact considering the quantity of debt that's outstanding and the inability of central banks to raise interest rates. The Fed funds rate is at 2.5%. And that's the highest of any of the major economies. If we look at the, for example, the UK base rate, the UK is the only other major central bank that does not have negative yields, and yet the interest rate in the UK is at 75 basis points. When we look at the ECB's, I can't remember exactly what it is. It's the they look at the 2 week refinance rate, if I remember correctly. Or if it's not 2 weeks, it's going to be 2 months. But we know that the UK, or excuse me, the EU has not been able to get off the zero bound. I think that's everyone pretty much accepts that fact, and neither has Japan. One of the things that differentiates Japan and Europe from the USA and UK is demographics. The UK has got a lot more immigrants, and that has helped to inflate the average age, or well, I guess deflate the average age of workers. The USA is not as old as the as either Europe or Japan, not least because of a higher replacement rate in terms of the population, and also because of the large numbers of people flooding over the border. Well, that ensures that we do have this interest rate differential between Europe and the USA, and Japan and the USA. But the much bigger question is, how long is that sustainable for? And the fact that we have seen these central banks show a distinct inability to get off the zero bound, well, that also has to, I think, that we really should be thinking about then, what is the possibility that they're going to be able to do anything in terms of normal monetary policy when we do have the next problem? Well, there are two answers to this question. The first is, central banks will do whatever they can to prolong this bull market in the hope that growth will pick up, in the hope that governments will try to rein in their spending programs. Now, however vain that a hope that might be, it certainly beats the alternative. So that's a, I think, a rather important point, that central banks have a very clear incentive to prolong this economic expansion, and they have got a clear justification for doing so because of the restrictions they have in terms of policy in order to deal with a future crisis. Then, of course, they don't have the inflationary pressures. For example, here, when we look at Australia, I think when people go back and think about where interest rates were back in the period ahead of the financial crisis, no one ever thought that Australian interest rates could fall to 1%. But what we are now seeing in Australia is that they are cutting interest rates. The government has announced a new fiscal stimulus, and they're easing mortgage lending rules. So they have pulled out all the stops in order to arrest the decline in the property market and in the economy generally. Well, that is translating into a significant revival in terms of the stock market, and the index has been accelerating higher since these moves were announced, and it persists. It does look increasingly likely that we are going to see it go right back up and test the peaks from ahead of the financial crisis, but that's really not all that far away. And we had a lengthy consolidation below 6,000, so it may just pause at 7,000 and keep going. And I think that's another thing that we do see towards the end of major bull markets. It's not simply that defensive shares start to rally. We've definitely seen defensives doing better, and not least because they offer a bond proxy. But the other point is that commodity-oriented markets do tend to do well in the latter stages of a bull market. Well, commodities themselves are not doing especially well. And that is suggestive that we're not quite at the end of the bull market yet. Copper prices are coming down to the lower side of their range. Well, one big question then is, why aren't commodities doing better? If we are seeing defensives doing better, we've seen valuations increase. If this is approaching the latter stages of a cycle, why is it that commodities are not doing better? Well, a big part of the reason is because China is not doing better, and China is now such a massive swing producer of consumer of commodities, that it is having a negative effect not just on copper, but on all of the industrial metals. Iron ore at the moment is a little bit of an anomaly, but there are very specific supply issues with regard to iron ore, and steel consumption has been reasonably steady. So iron ore has been a bit of an exception, but tin prices broke downwards this week. Nickel, despite the fact that it is a major component in new battery technology, has not been rallying. Tin prices will need to do better than they did today. They'll need to push back up into that overhead trading range to confirm a failed downside break. The nickel price also needs to start rallying from current levels if the benefit of the doubt is to continue to be given to support building in here. What we definitely need to see, though, is that China persists in its fiscal stimulus. China ran over a $500 billion stimulus in 2018. Li Keqiang was speaking in here this week and saying that they are not going to flood the market with liquidity on this occasion. But China's economy is slowing down. It is highly dependent on continued sponsorship from the central government. Well, they are obviously worried about the potential for overheating, or indeed for the scope for a bubble to form in the property markets. They've been trying to clamp down on the shadow banking sector, but that has had a deleterious effect on the regional banks. We've definitely seen that the default rate has been rising. That's the one big unknowable with China. Nobody knows what the natural default rate is, because defaults are a relatively new phenomenon. What we're definitely seeing, however, is that the targeting of CEOs of major companies is persisting. That was a major trend last year, where there was a spate of business titans in China that either died, disappeared, were found in compromising positions, and basically were brought back into line. That was particularly true of JD.com. Then there was also in here this week the story of a business titan running a major property company that was accused of molesting children. Well, quite whether that is true or not, it also helps to highlight that if you are on the wrong side of the administration, then these types of activities tend to be used in against you. There is another way of thinking about it, is that in order to get into a position of power in an intrinsically corrupt system, then everybody has got some dirt in the closet that can be used against them. Now, when we then think about what we can expect from the Chinese economy, well, it is exceedingly likely that there is going to continue to be support, because without this monetary and fiscal support, the stock market or the economy generally would be in real trouble, and they cannot tolerate the scope of a downside that would be presented by the property market pulling back. Well, that suggests that China is going to continue to run significant deficits. Then, when we think about what's going on in Europe, Christine Lagarde is going to be the next head of the ECB. She's a lawyer and doesn't really have an economics background, interestingly, so is Jay Powell. He's a lawyer by training, although he did spend some time working at the Fed before being appointed. Well, that suggests that there are some big rule followers or rule setters that are at the head of two of the most important central banks in the world. They have one of the other things that we can look at lawyers to do is they look at precedent. And the precedent that we have in central banks is to do whatever is necessary to ensure adequate liquidity hits the markets. Well, that suggests that Europe is going to move into negative interest rates. And that is going to put even further downward pressure on the yields right across the board. I think one of the points that is less understood by the English-speaking world is that Europe is on a trajectory towards a federalist state. The compression in yields that we saw this week in Italy is the result of populists being co-opted once more into the federalist program. When, and also there is going to be an election in Greece this week, and Tsipras is likely to lose the premiership. He's another populist that was co-opted by the EU. They get into office by making big promises. Then they look at the prospect of surviving without access to the federal, excuse me, to the ECB bond buying programs or access to ample liquidity, and then they pull back from the precipice. The problem is you can't go back to voters having made such aggressive promises and then tell them that you're going to do it the next time. Nobody will believe you. There is a certain quality of the boy who cried wolf from Aesop's fables to all of this. And but the much bigger point is that Europe is moving towards a federalist system, and it is doing so on the timetable set up by the ECB or the European creditors. They want to get to a point where the debt to GDP ratios are harmonized, and it is really only then that they will present a federalist system as a fait accompli to the European Parliament. Then it is only at that point that they will start to introduce a common deposit insurance corporation, a common fiscal policy, and clear transfer mechanisms. They want to see a point where there is going to be harmonization. That is the only way that they can get over the moral hazard question. And it is the moral hazard question, and that has got unfortunately, it got very Teutonic overtones that the spending and profligacy of the peripheral nations, the fact that they had borrowed way more than that they could ever pay back, that kind of moral hazard is not going to be tolerated by the electorates of Germany or the Netherlands or Austria. And we're not going to get the kind of institutional the institution formation in Europe until that moral hazard risk has been obviated. Well, that means then the timetable that the Europeans have is 2029. But that's another decade of fiscal austerity. And the one thing that is not being considered is that eventually there is going to be a populist leader, because what happens in these types of situations is that the conditions tend to get progressively more polarized. It isn't that the populations of heavily indebted countries who have had to endure the significant loss of living standards, lower wages, and embarrassment are going to just lie down and accept their fates. The one point, I guess, that comes against that conclusion is the age of the population in Europe. There's a lot of talk about youth unemployment, but very little talk in Europe about the number of people who are in the youth program or in the youth demographic. Europe just does not have young people, and therefore they're not rebelling. They're sitting at home. If this were the 1960s, where Europe had a surfeit of young people and no jobs, they would be out protesting in the streets. You would have had a very different outcome. But Europe just does not have that number of young people. And I think that's one of the bigger points that I just don't see discussed. If anything, the fact that Europe is older and that generally older people, they protest at the ballot box rather than on the streets. Well, what that suggests is that we are going to continue to see a polarization in the political atmosphere, that there are going to be progressively more extreme populists elected. Eventually, one of them will look at the precipice and step off of it. That's when you get an existential problem in Europe. That is the clear risk. That is one of the things that is not being priced into the market because there's no need to right now. There is no evidence that someone like that is about to get elected. And what that suggests is that we can expect the stock market in Europe to do better from here, that we're going to see negative interest rates. That is going to create an environment where there is demand for a yield, that stock markets will respond favorably to negative interest rates. And then we have to think about the outlook for other assets. Because if the Federal Reserve is at the top of its interest rate cycle and has historically cut by something like 500 basis points during recessions, then we have to consider that the Federal Reserve is going to get back down to zero and may have more difficulty the next time raising interest rates. There is the potential that we have a bond bubble inflating. If we have to think about how interest rates could rise in future, it would be because there is a solvency problem. Well, the only way we could have a solvency problem is if we therefore get a. Well, I guess the other way of thinking about it is that the only way we could get a an insolvency problem at the federal level is if central banks refuse to buy the bonds. And the only way they would refuse to buy the bonds is if there was an inflationary problem. So the one thing that is going to be most important to monitor is inflationary pressures. Well, there is scope for inflation to pick up, not least if property prices continue to expand, or if we start to see some of the problems that are outstanding in the commodity markets starting to become a pressure. One thing that has not affected commodity prices has been the floods that have occurred in the U.S. Midwest that delayed soybean planting, Asian swine flu in China and its impact on the swine herd there, and then also the proliferation of the army worm in China. These do represent problems potentially for commodity prices. We have not yet seen an impact from that, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be monitoring these prices. One thing we can definitely say is that soybeans, for example, is not expensive, and it's at the lower side of the range. The lower side of this range that's persisted since 2006 is the upper side of the a very volatile ranging phase that persisted between approximately 1973 and 2006. So a failure at this level would represent a very clear scope for the price to trend back down towards the 500 cent level. At that point, farmers would be going bust left and right. So then that would create the kind of upward scope for commodity prices to rally. But these are longer term considerations. At the moment, we just don't see the evidence for the potential for this first step above the base to be curtailed. Secular bull markets in commodities are best defined by an incremental rise in the marginal cost of production. We've definitely seen that historically in the oil market, and there is no reason to believe that that is going to be anything but the case in future. When we do look at oil prices, well, it is when oil prices are surging higher that we tend to get real problems in the market. But oil prices are not surging higher. In fact, there has been a fairly significant amount of downward pressure on the oil price over the course of the last few months. That's within the context of a longer-term ranging phase, that we are in a secular bear market for oil because of the quantity of supply that becomes economic above $40. Generally speaking, what happens in secular bull markets for energy is that we get massive investment in new supply. That new supply comes in at a somewhat higher production level or break-even point than was justifiable historically. Well, then that represents a new floor. Well, now the new floor is probably around $50. So prices will not spend a great deal of time. Excuse me. Sorry. Prices will not spend a great deal of time below that level. So when we think about where are we in terms of this broader cycle, it does look increasingly likely that we are going to get the kind of liquidity infusions that could really help to boost asset prices. But we know that we are at a point where valuations are reasonable. And in terms of the forward PE ratio, we're at approximately at the middle of the range in terms of the longer term history. So if the market is being supported right now by the potential for additional stimulus and the health of the US economy, then there is scope for a bubble period to begin from here. That it is massive margin expansion that could contribute to a significant break upwards in terms of the stock market. When we look at the stock market and just simply think about the longer term trends, well, we know that ranges are explosions waiting to happen. And this market has been going sideways for a year and a half. And when it started going sideways at the beginning of 2015, the last range was about a year and a half. When it started going sideways at the beginning of 2011, that range was about a year and a half long. Well, we're also in the second half of the third year of the US presidential cycle. This is about when we would anticipate that there is going to be some additional stimulus provided to the market. So that's an additional point. What I find particularly comforting about the market right now is that it's very easy to monitor because we had an upside Q reversal from the region of the trend mean. We've had upside follow-through. The market has pushed on to new high ground. There is a short-term overbought condition. The rather positive jobs report that we had today that took some wind out of the sails for the momentum move we've had over the last couple of weeks. But we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside, provided the lows put in during that upside weekly key reversal continue to hold. That's what we would anticipate, that having had a consolidation in the region of the peak, that the lows should hold. If they don't hold, well, then we're pushing back down into the range. The breakout would not have been sustained. That would suggest that there is ample supply above the market. If it pulls back below the trend mean and encounters resistance in the region of the trend mean, well, then we're talking about not just a failed upside break, but a further deterioration in terms of the consistency. Well, that would be then grounds for really having a long think about top formation development overall. But we haven't seen any of that. What we have seen is a narrowing of leadership. And again, that is representative of late stage activity, that you do get narrowing leadership, you do get the outperformance of the defensive sector. It's usually after you get an inverted yield curve that markets tend to do well. They generally tend to do well for at least another 6 to 9 months after the inversion. I think that one important point is that the 10 and 2 year spread is at about 18 basis points. It did not become inverted. The yield curve spread that the Federal Reserve uses, which is the difference between the 10 year and the 3 month, did become inverted and stayed inverted for a full quarter. Well, that suggests that investor, or at least the Federal Reserve, thinks that there is a risk of a recession, and they'll do whatever is necessary to avoid that. Therefore, there is the scope here that we are going to have a bubble, that by refusing to tolerate the risk of a recession now, that the potential recession that happens later will be deeper. And the range of corrective measures that will have to be instituted to deal with it will be even deeper. I think that is where we are in terms of this cycle right now, that there is clear bubble risk and that we are definitely seeing some acceleration in terms of the kinds of companies that are benefiting from the outlook generally. When we think, for example, about Visa, which has got a long history of increasing dividends. It's been increasing dividends at approximately 20% a year for as long as it has been listed, then the pace of this advance is picking up. When we think about Microsoft, they've adopted the subscription business model that has turned a highly cyclical business into one that has got bond-like characteristics. And that also represents a trend that is picking up pace. Well, then we have to think about what is it that is now starting to perform? What is the sector that is performing? It's the bond-like, or the bond proxies are doing well. And historically, those have been the consumer staples and the utilities. But in this cycle, you also have the subscription business model companies because their cash flows have taken on bond-like characteristics as a result of the business model that they've adopted. And this subscription business model eating the world mantra is the rationale that is likely to help to push on to new highs this emerging bubble phase. When the media is talking about the subscription business model eating the world, when subscriptions are on the front page of Time magazine, then that will be the time when we need to pay particular attention to this. But as long as we're at the point where central banks are only just beginning to start cutting interest rates and are willing to do anything to ensure that this expansion persists, that suggests we're in the bubble phase. Eventually, when it does end, then we're going to have a recession. Well, recessions do set up incredible buying opportunities. We are at a point where technological innovation is accelerating. The rise of the global consumer means that there is going to be an additional 3 billion consumers over the course of the next 30 years. And the innovations we're seeing in the energy sector are likely to help to contain the rise in energy prices. So those are the kinds of things that can drive the second half of a secular bull market, but perhaps are not enough to avoid the scope for a recession when this bubble phase eventually ends. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.